You are. From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Prosecutors told the International Criminal Court at The Hague today that Slobodan Milosevic committed almost medieval savagery in the crimes he oversaw while president of Yugoslavia. Today marked the first day in the landmark war crimes trial, which could take up to 2 years before delivering a verdict. Back in Belgrade this morning, Serbs watched as their former president took his seat in the courtroom. The experience of seeing their former leader on trial in an international court left some incensed and some eager to move on. I spoke with Ivana Konstantinovic earlier today from Belgrade. She's a reporter with Radio TV B92 in Belgrade. I asked her how important the proceedings are to the Serbian people.
Well, it's very amazing because we thought that this trial could be very interesting for Serbian people, and they will look forward to hear Milosevic, just to see how he acts, whether he might sound funny or whether he wish he might sound proud in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that people are not that interested in Milosevic. That's something very amazing. They weren't even calling our TV station or to react or something. We were expecting busy lines or something, you know.
What do you think is beyond that, Ivana Konstantinovic? Have they written Milosevic all off already? Do they think it's preordained that he'll be found guilty? Or do they simply not want to think about the bloody past?
I think that they don't want to think about him anymore because, you know, he was ruling for 13 years. We were looking at him for 13 years. He was on television. He was on the radio. Everything was related to him. So right now I think that people are tired of Milosevic and they don't even think of his future. Of course, there are people who are still supporting him, but that is a very small number of people.
What is the range of thinking there in Belgrade among Serbs about the fairness and legitimacy of the Milosevic trial in The Hague?
Well, that's something the analysts, lots of political leaders think that it won't be a fair trial because they consider Hague Tribunal as a political trial. Some of them, maybe Prime Minister, they say, okay, it is a fair trial because it's a very public trial. You can see mm-hmm. it on television. You can see it everywhere. But I think that for 10 years or even when the Hague Tribunal was established, there was some kind of certain opinion that it's a political court. So that remained.
Have Serbs accepted some kind of responsibility for the ethnic cleansing of the 90s, for the deaths of 250,000 non-Serbs in Croatia, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, in Kosovo? Do people in the street feel a sense of responsibility, or do they feel it's Milosevic's fault, or do they put the blame elsewhere?
Well, I think that it's a new course of thinking, because all this distinction between individual responsibility and collective responsibility and all the processes in this region about reconciliation and everything just made to this stand that people are thinking of individual responsibility. Maybe there are few of them who are, I don't know, involved in those actions or they're supporting Milosevic, so they want to recognize the responsibility of their leaders or of themselves, I guess. But I think that the main opinion is that there is some only individual responsibility, and that is something which is the main, the first headline in all the news that Carlo Del Ponte said that it is individual responsibility.
And by that she means Milosevic's responsibility.
Well, okay, that has to be proven yet, but all the leaders, all the commanders, whether they're Serbian, Bosnian, or Croatian, that is something that all the region must accept.
When Serbs see the images of Milosevic in the dock at The Hague on trial, do they feel as though they as a people are also on trial?
I don't think so. Maybe I could speak on behalf of those people who are supporting him, although I'm not supporting him. They see themselves as they are on trial. They see themselves as, you know, people who supported Milosevic, who are fighting with him, and they think that they are on trial, that Serbia is on trial. But the most people, this kind of new moderate Serbia, we don't consider ourselves as to be tried on Hague Tribunal. because I think that the majority in Serbia just thinks as a Hague tribunal, as a court, which has to find individual responsibility for war crimes.
There's been speculation that if Milosevic is found guilty, that it could ultimately lead to a kind of judgment against Serbian people at large, and maybe even to reparations against neighboring countries and populations. Is there concern about a demand for reparations from the Serbs?
Yeah, I think that that's the only concern and serious implication of this trial, that all the countries involved in the war could ask for retaliation of after the war. But I think that history must show what happened in a view of responsibility, because Milosevic will be a Serbian leader in history yet to come. So that is something that maybe could characterize Serbian people as some kind of, I don't know, genocidal nation or something like that. But that's something that that I could not tell from this point of view.
I don't know if you've done any polling there at Radio TV B92, but I wonder if Serbs tend to feel that the process in The Hague is headed toward a legitimate outcome of justice.
Well, I think that lots of things can't be proven that good. Sometimes, you know, you have so many things in those indictments which cannot be proven. I think that people in Serbia are not thinking as a Hague tribunal of some tribunal who that will find who is guilty or not. I think that only individual responsibility is something that must be put to the first place. And when we're talking about war, no one in Serbia even knew what was going on there because of, you know, media and everything which happened during Milosevic's regime.
Ivana Konstantinovic is a reporter with Radio TV B92 in Belgrade. A milestone in history passed this morning with the opening statements in the trial of Slobodan Milosevic. Milosevic is on trial for genocide and war crimes in the Balkans over a period of 10 years while he was president of Yugoslavia. But many Serbs feel that finding Milosevic guilty of genocide means a guilty verdict for them as well. In her opening remarks, prosecutor Carla Del Ponte said that it is the individual on trial, not the country.
Our unique contribution is to bring to justice the persons responsible for the worst crimes known to humankind. The crime of genocide, crimes against humanity, and the other crimes within the jurisdiction of this tribunal are not local affairs, and their prosecution may be beyond the capability of national courts.
Court officers say it could take up to 2 years to hear all the testimony from hundreds of witnesses. Milosevic himself refuses to appoint lawyers to defend him and says he does not recognize the legitimacy of the court. In many ways, the tribunal itself will be on trial to an international audience to prove its effectiveness as a court of global justice. Are you ready for the brave new world of international justice? Are you comforted that justice will be done at The Hague? Are you confident that justice will be done at The Hague? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now is Anne-Marie Slaughter. She's professor of international law at Harvard Law School. Good evening and welcome, Anne-Marie Slaughter.
Good evening. Pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you. Also with us, I'm very happy to say, is our on-point guest analyst, Anthony Lewis, former columnist with the New York Times. Good evening and a special welcome, Anthony Lewis.
I'm also glad to be here.
Well, we're all glad. Anne-Marie Slaughter, it was a historic step today. It is, I guess, unprecedented for a head of state to be brought into such a court on charges of genocide. And clearly we are seeing here a broadening of international criminal justice when even heads of state can be tried for war crimes, including those that took place inside their own borders. As you look at what's likely to be a long trial and with a very uncooperative subject being tried, how do you feel about the shape of the system that's been constructed to try Slobodan Milosevic?
I have a mixed reaction. On the one hand, there is no question that this trial is the culmination of certainly a decade, if not decades, of work toward building both a body of international criminal law and, equally important, building a tribunal that could apply such law to be able to give voice to the international community when fundamental norms of international law have been violated. Crimes against humanity, genocide, grave war crimes are crimes against all of us. And in that, we, the global community, have not had a voice. So from that point of view, it is a historic moment. And the law that this tribunal will make is historic in the sense that we are developing a body of law that will be applied by many tribunals in the future, both international and national. The mixed reaction, though, is that although I have no question that the Hague Tribunal has technical jurisdiction over Slobodan Milosevic, he fits within the categories of jurisdiction that lawyers create, there's a political problem with the fact that he was sent to The Hague before the Serbian process of justice had a chance to run its course. And if we're really to build a global legal system, a global international criminal justice system, we are going to have to let nations try their own and only step in internationally when it's clear that they are either unable or unwilling to do that.
In this case, Anne-Marie Slaughter, do you think there was any realistic possibility that Slobodan Milosevic might have had a fair and thorough trial in his home country? Might the end result of that have been justice denied in another way?
Well, I think we don't know. I think it's quite possible he would have been tried for corruption and other economic crimes. And we don't know that what would have happened once the myth had been stripped away and his political opponents had gained in power. There are certainly Serbs who say that it would have been possible to try him domestically. Somebody like Alexei Gilas takes that position. But I'm not certain we had to make a choice. If, in fact, he had been either not tried or tried only for economic crimes such as corruption, the international community could then still have exercised jurisdiction over war crimes and genocide and crimes against humanity. As I said, we have jurisdiction. The question is simply when we should exercise it. And everybody understandably wants to see Milosevic in the dock, but we're now trying to stand for principles of the rule of law that are supposed to counter those passions.
Anthony Lewis, how about it? What do you see here? This is, of course, a tribunal created by the United Nations. Is the United Nations overstepping its authority? Has it been too eager in going directly after Milosevic, as Anne-Marie Slaughter suggests? Is there a overstepping of bounds here, or is this just what ought to be happening?
Well, the decision was actually made by the authorities in Belgrade. They didn't want to try Mr. Milosevic, as I understand it, and they quickly got him out of the country and sent him to The Hague. And that's a political decision, which I can well understand. He was a man who had had not only, as the indictments charged, carried out a brutal few years in all of the Balkans, or that part of the Balkans, but had done terrible things in his own country. And they had upset his rule in a most dramatic and almost miraculous way, and they were living in a, as they thought, a very dangerous way in which he might reclaim power, and they mm-hmm. wanted him out of there.
Mm-hmm. So in your view, it's a case where the authorities in Milosevic's own country said, thanks but no thanks, please you try him.
But there wasn't a formal proceeding, as Professor Slaughter says, quite fairly. But my impression is that they were determined to have the trial in The Hague and not to go through what would certainly have been a politically very difficult thing for them with a domestic trial or a set of trials.
Anne-Marie Slaughter, is it too much to hope that a country that's gone through the kind of turmoil and violence that Yugoslavia has, and this will often, of course, be the backdrop if in the future other heads of state come up on charges of genocide and war crimes, there's always going to be a kind of ravaged home country situation. Can we really expect that country then to be effective in trying the leader that helped drive it into those circumstances?
Well, it's obviously difficult, and as Tony points out, there are, of course, contending political factions, and in this case, the newly elected Democratic government did want Milosevic out. Obviously, there were other parties who wanted to wait until the Supreme Court ruled. So when I say that the process wasn't completed, it was that they essentially short-circuited their own judicial process. But that's problematic for those of us who would uphold it here. I think at its best, an international court should serve as a trigger or a backstop for domestic processes. So if you think about Pinochet, the fact, if you'd had an international criminal court playing the same role as the British court, mm-hmm. you're basically trying to force the Chileans to try him, because if they don't, we will.
I'm Marie Slaughter. We'll come back to that point. We're talking about Slobodan Milosevic and the historic trial that's begun today at The Hague. Are you ready for the brave new world of international justice? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
909-9287.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Last July, former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic was adamant in his refusal to recognize the authority of the International Criminal Court.
I consider this tribunal false tribunal and indictments false indictments. It is illegal being not appointed by UN General Assembly, so I have no need to appoint counsel to illegal organ.
Now, as then, a 250,000 people, non-Serbs, are dead in the Balkans. Now, Slobodan Milosevic is on trial. It began today. It may take 2 years. It's breaking new ground. A head of state charged with genocide, charged with war crimes, charged with crimes against humanity. Are you pleased or frightened to see a former head of state on trial? Are you confident justice will be done in the trial of Slobodan Milosevic? We're in new territory here. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined by Anne-Marie Slaughter. She's professor of international law at the Harvard Law School, and by our guest analyst tonight, Anthony Lewis, former columnist with the New York Times. Tony Lewis, take us back to the Nuremberg trials, if you will, and the precedent that was established there and how that has unfolded across the decades to bring us to where we are now with Slobodan Milosevic at The Hague.
The Nuremberg court was a victor's court. The winners of World War II set up this court with a chief prosecutor, an American Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson. It was a court. Despite it being a victor's court, some people were acquitted. Different sentences were handed out. It went through what was recognizably a process of evidence, and a great deal of evidence was brought out, which has had a permanent effect on the world's knowledge of Nazi horrors. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the same way that the South African Commission on Reconciliation, Truth and Reconciliation, brought out some of the horrors of apartheid. I think what's happened here is that, in part, a recognition by the world that these horrors were really not bearable. There's an irony in this. After the Holocaust and the Nuremberg trial, I thought, and I think many people thought, that we wouldn't stand for that again, never again.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, many other genocides happened, and we didn't stop them. There's a book coming out shortly by Samantha Power called A Problem from Hell, mm-hmm. America and the Age of Genocide. I'd read that book, your blood curdles at the terrible things that happened, not just in Bosnia and Rwanda, Kosovo, but on and on. And there was a determination that we had to stop it somewhere, stop it with trying to punish Pinochet or Milosevic or whoever it was, to make heads of state understand that if they callously slaughtered human beings, they might have to pay the price. I have to add that it corresponded with a political necessity when Bill Clinton was president. It was then that we pressed the UN Security Council to create this Hague Tribunal. He was reluctant to get into the war in Bosnia until very much later. And this setting up this court was a way of acting without exposing American forces to the chances of war.
And yet, Anne-Marie Slaughter, the United States has been famously resistant to the idea of international justice in other settings.
Well, it's a sad fact because, indeed, we were the chief proponents of the Bosnia Tribunal, and indeed we believed in it when many other countries said either it couldn't happen or if it did happen, it would come to nothing. In many ways, our support of the Bosnia Tribunal reflected our belief that if you set up an independent prosecutor and an independent legal process, it will take on a life of its own. Having done that and having also pushed for an international criminal court and having played an extremely important role in the negotiations on an international criminal court, at the last moment we blinked. At the last moment when we had to face the possibility, however remote, and it is indeed a very remote possibility, that our own soldiers might hypothetically be brought before such a tribunal, we were not willing to acknowledge that the same rules could apply to us as we wish to apply to the rest of the world.
Well, what's the real risk of that? If we're in a, we are in a new world now with the head of state facing these charges and the courts are proceeding, what are the parameters that decide who gets called up on charges? Could, for example, some Islamic fundamentalist group attempt to have George W. Bush brought up on charges because of the status given to the detainees in Guantanamo, Cuba, or because of civilian deaths in Afghanistan? Would we see that kind of thing where every head of state is facing charges at The Hague all the time?
No, for a number of reasons. Certainly anyone can suggest that these are war crimes, but that's no different from today. If we were to read the press, in many, certainly in many Islamic countries today, you would find these charges launched at our leaders. But so you could suggest them, but you have an independent prosecutor who is first place has to pick and choose and doesn't have infinite resources and so is going to concentrate on the worst cases. And second, who will apply independent judgment to what the law says. So when it was suggested that NATO should be prosecuted for war crimes in Kosovo, the current tribunal that is trying Milosevic did have jurisdiction over that investigation, and the prosecutor did investigate those allegations, and she concluded that there was not enough evidence to actually go forward with any kind of prosecution.
And yet, Anna Marie Slaughter, we feel your resistance, your concern that even war-torn and shambles Yugoslavia didn't have a chance to have its first whack at this trial. What is that about? Of course, this tribunal, this court was established by the United Nations. Are you in the black helicopter crowd? You're afraid the United Nations is invading the justice systems of the world with some, you know, terrible epidemic of intervention?
No, I'm taking exactly the position that the U.S. government took until this administration, which was we need to change the rules from the current international tribunal, because the current tribunal has what we call as lawyers' primary jurisdiction. That just means if they want to try somebody, they get to. What we insisted on and got, I think rightly, in the International Criminal Court was the reverse, was a system of jurisdiction whereby national courts get first crack. And only if they are unable or unwilling to prosecute does the international court step in. And that's very important because that means countries with a good military justice system, as we have a very good military justice system, can take care of their own problems. It's only going to be situations in which either a country has come apart completely or they're simply unwilling to actually take care of their own internal problems, that then the international community has the right and indeed it feels the necessity of stepping in.
Anne Marie Slaughter, Tony Lewis, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. Glenn is on the line. Welcome, Glenn. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. It's an honor to be able to talk with such distinguished guests. I would have to agree with Anne Marie that I believe that the United States has blinked when it comes to international justice. I think that the International Criminal Tribunal may be one of the last tribunals that the United States is going to participate in a long time. And as the only superpower left in the world, obviously what we do and what we say has tremendous influence in the world.
So you're afraid that American reluctance to get into this system may lead to its demise?
It's certainly not going to allow it to be as important and as powerful as the International Criminal Court can be if the United States participated.
Glenn, thanks for your observation. Tony Lewis, let me put that to you. Frame this up for us so we all understand. What has the United States signed up for here, and what has it resisted? And what are the implications of that resistance?
President Clinton, on his last day in office, I think it was, or the next to last day, signed the draft treaty negotiated in Rome for a permanent. This is different from the Hague Tribunal, for a permanent international criminal court that could try charges of war crimes, genocide, and so on, anywhere in the world, not just the former Yugoslavia. It had been opposed by the Pentagon for the reason that Professor Slaughter mentioned earlier, you know, the fear that American soldiers might someday find themselves defendants. President Clinton signed it, but he knew that there was no chance of Senate ratification because conservatives in the Senate were opposed to it for the Pentagon's reason. And indeed, Senator Helms, Jesse Helms, tried early on in the new Senate after President Bush's election to condition other legislation on our telling anyone who signed, who actually operated the international, took part in the International Criminal Tribunal, that they would be punished by the United States, that there would be sanctions on them for doing so. That weapon was dropped after September 11, but that's where it stands.
So the U.S. is now on board or not?
No, because we've signed the piece of paper, but we haven't ratified the treaty, and there's no present prospect of our doing so.
Are we alone in this, or are there others who have joined us?
Well, some have not agreed to the treaty, and there are such countries as Iraq, and most of the others are, in fact,
Yemen, Libya.
President Bush called the axis of evil.
Yemen, Libya, and Iraq. Well, but there's a trend here. Anne-Marie Slaughter, if the United States doesn't become a more enthusiastic supporter of International Criminal Court, and that is beyond the specific tribunal set up for Yugoslavia with U.S. approval in 93, is that court doomed, or do we have a kind of irresistible movement into the future here of more UN-sanctioned international justice?
I think the court is not doomed. It's going to look more like the Landmines Treaty, in which all of the other NATO countries, all of our other principal allies support this court. Indeed, Britain was a very important supporter of the court. That's enough support to make it an effective institution. Glenn was right to say it will not be as effective as it would be if the United States was behind it, but it will, in fact, come into operation. It will demonstrate that it is a useful instrument of international and national policy, and the United States is going to be standing on the sidelines. It will have real impact in the sense that we will not be there shaping the rules of procedure, the working out the details of the substantive law. And more generally, we're going to look like the superpower on the sidelines.
Anne-Marie Slaughter, Anthony Lewis, stand by. I want to bring another guest in with us now. Nina Bang Jensen is Executive Director and Counsel for the Coalition for International Justice. It's a group that monitors fairness in the proceedings of the International Criminal Court. Good evening and welcome, Nina Bang Jensen.
Thank you.
What's your view as you look out at the Slobodan Milosevic trial? Are we setting good precedent here for international justice?
Oh, so far, it's just remarkable precedent. The very idea a little over a year ago that he would be there and that he would be facing this kind of scrutiny is just remarkable. It sends a very clear message and the most important message to the people of the former Yugoslavia who certainly never thought this would happen.
Do you have any pause over Emery Slaughter has suggested that this whole procedure may have brushed past the national judicial system a little too quickly? Do you think that the international courts are impinging on the sovereignty of national courts here?
Well, this is a little bit different from your whole ICC discussion. These courts were created, both the UN Court for Rwanda and the Court for the former Yugoslavia, at a realization that the local courts were either unwilling or unable to do this fairly, and that it was important to step in and provide some vehicle. The courts in the former Yugoslavia, I mean, only a year ago Milosevic was sitting in power, are still highly political. They are not independent, and there's no sense of, for a witness in Kosovo or a witness in Bosnia or Croatia, would not feel convinced at all that they could get any kind of fair trial in Belgrade.
Mm-hmm. Nina Van Jensen, stand by. Kevin is on the line. Welcome, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello. I have to preface my comment with just one thing. Anthony Lewis?
Yes.
I'm very pleased that your retirement hasn't involved not participating in public life. You're correct.
As are we.
The Constitution, the humanity of immigrants is something that has been very, very, very important to me and a lot of other people.
Hear, hear.
I wish your retirement doesn't includes a lot of public interventions.
Well, thank you very much.
I commend you, the people responsible for this program, for having you on. I'm in support of Milosevic, being tried, but I find that the legitimacy of the trial, or even the possibility of establishing some kind of legitimate precedent for future action by such international courts, is being called into question.
So what's the problem in your mind, Kevin?
East Timor, 200,000 people. It's something I followed very closely. Genocidal mass murder is living in luxury in Jakarta now. And
so you're saying why isn't an international court at work on that instance?
Yeah, and Anne-Marie mentioned that if a national court has the will and ability, fine. And we gave Indonesia the opportunity, and they haven't done it, and they're unable to do it, and they're unwilling to do it.
Kevin, it's a good point. Thanks for making it. Anthony Lewis, Kevin's point echoes Madeleine Albright on the U.S. military. What's the point of having it if we don't use it? Here's the International Criminal Court, and he's saying it's not being used too much. It's not profligate. It's being used too selectively. Who's to decide?
Well, I agree with his feelings about the Indonesians who participated in the slaughter in East Timor. They should be brought before an international tribunal. The same is true in Cambodia, where the other great genocide occurred. Of course, the Khmer Rouge slaughter of perhaps 800,000 people.
Where the U.N. has just given up.
Just given up because it can't work out an agreement with the government of Cambodia. Well, my answer to that is that those things are extremely regrettable, and I'm very, very sorry about them. But that doesn't mean we should give up what we have. Nothing is perfect in international life any more than elsewhere. And I think we must proceed with the court we have, and that has worked, you know, actually amazingly well. When the War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia started, as I guess Anne Marie said, it was just sort of written off. How can this get anywhere? Mm. We had a very hard time even appointing a prosecutor because the Russians kept blocking suggested names. Mm-hmm. But by God, we now have a court that really is operating, that has brought the alleged mastermind of this slaughter to the trial. And, you know, we should be glad of what we have.
May I add something? In East Timor, in fact, the UN does have a special court.
Yes.
It's a hybrid court. UN supervised and actually operated initially, but there are domestic East Timorese involved.
What's the role of the UN then? Is it oversight or is it?
No. They brought some of the judges, but some of the judges are also East Timorese.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it is becoming a more domestic court. We actually have five people on the ground there doing criminal investigatory work. They have jurisdiction to get some of the Indonesians. It's simply that the Indonesians are not cooperating.
But is a court meaningful if it doesn't have the authority or the teeth to go in and find and put?
It's meaningful to the people who are having some of their cases handled now. It's not as meaningful as it one hopes it eventually will be when the Indonesians realize that, I hope, that there will be sanctions on them if they don't cooperate in response to specific orders. There have not been specific orders yet. So it's going to be an interesting thing to see. And it's also evidence that the Bush administration, I sort of reject this divide between the Bush and the Clinton administrations. Neither has been particularly good on the ICC, frankly. And I think we ought to give the Bush administration some credit for being quite good on the two ad hocs and actually being leading with the British on the tribunal in Sierra Leone and East Timor.
Nina Bang Jensen, Executive Director and Counsel for the Coalition for International Justice, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Anne-Marie Slaughter and Anthony Lewis, please stand by. We're going to be taking a short break. We're talking about international justice. As Slobodan Milosevic goes on trial today, the trial could take 2 years. Is the United States supportive enough of international justice? Is it too supportive? Will the Milosevic trial serve to deter future crimes against humanity? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about international justice. The system has geared up to handle the case of Slobodan Milosevic, who went on trial today at The Hague. There may be more to come. We hope there's not more genocide. But when and if there is, a message has gone out that even a head of state can be brought before an international court. So what do you think? Are you ready for the brave new world of international justice? Is international justice a breach of national sovereignty or a long overdue break on bloody dictators? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined tonight by Anne-Marie Slaughter. She's professor of international law at Harvard Law School, and by Anthony Lewis, longtime columnist with the New York Times, and by you. Fernando is on the line. Welcome, Fernando. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. I would just like to point out that your guests were being pretty accurate when saying that, just pointing out the United States stands towards this whole business, in that individual nations should have first the right to be able to judge their individuals before sending them to The Hague.
Do you feel that was properly observed in the case of Yugoslavia and Milosevic, Fernando?
Well, the fact is, in the case of Milosevic, or at least as far as I recall, the press covering the case back in Europe, was that Milosevic was sent to The Hague after NATO pressures were pushed upon the new government in Belgrade.
Fernando, thank you for your observation. Anne-Marie Slaughter, is it inevitable that some outside power is likely to have to be applied to bring out an alleged war criminal, even a head of state, to stand trial in the International Court of Justice? Or is Fernando suggesting that NATO, you know, was able to go in and play footloose and fancy free and Yugoslavia could not resist?
It's a complicated question. On the one hand, there's no question that many of the Serbs in government and observers feel that effectively, as one prominent commentator put it, there was a in other words, that NATO was saying, you want aid, you give us Milosevic and other war criminals. So on the one hand, the pressure of NATO was very important. On the other, again, it really depends on how it intersects with domestic politics. If you have a Democratic Party who actually wants to be able to get rid of Milosevic or to see him tried, then, in fact, NATO pressure can provide a very useful cover so that instead of saying, well, we are going to turn over a nationalist leader to an international tribunal, that government can say to its constituents, we might want to do this differently, but look, we need the aid, and we want to rejoin Europe, we want to rejoin the West, and this is the price.
Tony Lewis, can you imagine NATO serving as the steel behind a national court, creating the leverage that creates the possibility of a trial before it goes to The Hague?
I somewhat resist the word NATO, which makes it sound like it's a military operation.
Well, yeah.
It's not. It was, as Anne-Marie said, a political pressure. They wanted aid, money from the West. And the West said, listen, Serbia, we know you're in bad shape. You need aid, but we're not going to give it to you unless you try. You see that Milosevic is tried. And the only place I think that it was practical to try him was The Hague, because they weren't willing to do it. It was politically too difficult for them, I believe.
And once Slobodan Milosevic came into this system, Tony Lewis, what are the procedures that are followed by this international court? Is it the same kind of rules of evidence and argumentation that we would see in an American court? Can Americans and citizens of the entire world feel confident that there is the sort of depth of procedure that should lead to justice as we understand it?
I think so. The court has had some very distinguished judges, and including American judges. It doesn't have juries, but then European countries generally don't use juries anyway, continental countries, in criminal trials. And the prosecutorial staff, the first prosecutor was Judge Richard Goldstone of South Africa, who has a very high reputation. And I think the standards of the rules of evidence would be quite familiar to us, rather careful. Human Rights Watch, an American organization which is very careful about these things, has said that the tribunal functions according to the highest standards of international justice. I'm quoting that. So I'm confident that it would be recognized by most Americans as familiar and fair.
And Anne-Marie Slaughter, the court has 16 permanent judges elected to four-year terms by the UN General Assembly, and then, of course, a whole agency of prosecuting staff. Are you comfortable with the processes and structure of the court that Slobodan Milosevic faces?
I'm absolutely confident that it will be a fair trial. As Tony just mentioned, Patricia Wald, who was the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit and a potential nominee for attorney general, has served as the American judge for 2 years, and her reports are absolutely consistent with U.S. standards of justice. So in terms of a fair trial, there's not a problem. In terms of whether this is going to be a solution for the long term, as you've noted, this trial is going to take 2 years. Mm-hmm. There are an enormous number of counts. There are literally rooms and rooms full of documentary evidence, and the procedures that the court has developed in order to establish legitimacy internationally mean that it's going to be a relatively cumbersome instrument and should be used only to try major leaders, those whom we cannot otherwise capture. Again, this is going to suggest that we need a system where most people are tried in international courts, in national courts, excuse me, mm-hmm. and this is reserved for some pretty spectacular cases.
But I guess we'd rather have it be cumbersome and credible. Luigi is on the line. Welcome, Luigi. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Good
I was wondering, I'm a first-year law student, and I'm hopefully going to get involved in international law. And one of the things that occurred to me while listening was I'm glad that someone like Slobodan Milosevic was brought to trial. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, you know, who is assuming the ethical high ground here and saying who can and cannot be brought? Because, I mean, if you're talking about genocide, and this will sound, right, you know, severely left-wing, but if you're talking about genocide, the United States committed genocide of the American Indians, the Native American Indians, when they were first here. So what's the statute of limitations? You're going to go back to Cambodia. Go back to the 1800s.
So are you thinking that sooner or later a Western leader may end up in the dock?
I hope so, frankly speaking. And I'm not saying, I'm not pointing the finger at anybody, but I hope so because it has to be balanced.
Well,
who are we to assume a high ground? I mean, there are plenty of Palestinians right now who could say the very same. And I know, and frankly speaking, maybe unwittingly, your guests have pointed to this axis of evil in the Middle East. I beg to differ. There are a lot of human beings there who say, well, you know, the United States and NATO has done a great job of supporting Israel unilaterally and pissing off a lot of Palestinians. So,
Luigi, we hear your discomfort. Anne-Marie Slaughter, what comfort can you give that this power and authority will be equitably exercised around this very complicated planet?
In the first place, I want to point out that the fact that the tribunal may not get everyone is not an argument that it shouldn't get anyone, because, of course, it will be selective in some cases. It's very unlikely, for instance, that we are going to see Russian leaders in the dock for Chechnya, even though I strongly think there is a case that can be made. And as the caller pointed out, our own hands are not clean. Hmm. So but that's always an argument advanced against any effort in this direction, which is, well, you don't get everybody, and so you're inconsistent. Hmm. Nevertheless, it's better to try some people.
Anne-Marie Slaughter, our time is running down, and I apologize, but I'm going to have to thank you for coming on and say goodnight with that. Anne-Marie Slaughter is professor of international law at Harvard Law School. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Anthony Lewis, last word goes to you. Are you comforted by the new day dawning with Slobodan Milosevic's trial?
I have to say I'm comforted, but I just remind our listeners of one thing. Two of the principal villains, in my opinion, in the terrible things that happened in Bosnia, Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic, the so-called president and military leader of the Bosnian Serbs, who, among other things, allegedly, and I think they did, Mladic did, cold-bloodedly kill 7,000 Bosnian men captured at Srebrenica, they remain at large. They remain at large because our soldiers haven't wanted to take the risks of capturing them. They're still at large there, and the Serbian state has not been willing to give them up.
Justice remains imperfect. Anthony Lewis, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Miško Bilbija is a Serbian journalist who worked for Belgrade's defiantly independent radio station, B92, during the 90s. In this radio diary, he reflects on this historic moment and about how the trajectory of his life and the lives of the people he loves were changed by the reign of Slobodan Milosevic.
A couple of days ago, a very close friend of mine called me and asked me to do this short piece about Milosevic, or about last 10 years of wars and crisis and everything that was happening in ex-Yugoslavia. A personal, reflective piece, he said. Maybe just a young person or what the last 10 years has meant, if there is any light now, existential stuff. bleak or happy, just very personal. Jesus Christ, how can anyone be happy about this? Also, if I decide to be personal about it, there is going to be a lot of swearing and political incorrectness, a lot of hatred, ugly thoughts, nervousness, and I don't want to talk about it. So I'll stick to my friends. First of all, there is Alexander. He is my best friend, like a brother, I'd say, or even closer. Very clever guy, film critic, intellectual. In the summer of 1992, he almost lost himself when he was called to join the Yugoslav army in destroying the city of Vukovar. He was hiding, of course, like 90% of young men from Belgrade, but still he was losing it. While we were on the Adriatic coast of Montenegro that summer, he used to read, watch, or listen to every single war report he could find. He was terrified, like the rest of us, but still he was somehow possessed with the war. I wonder what would happen if he wasn't so successful in his hiding. Georgi is a perfect intellectual. He is a movie director. He writes stories, very good, and likes to listen to Japanese band Pizzicato 5. When all this started, he was very confused. At one point, he decided to go to the war to help the Serbian troops in liberating the ancient Serbian territories. At the end, he didn't go, but he was very close. I wonder what would happen if he went there. Would he ever come back as a normal person? Or would he ever come back at all? Then, there is Ivan. He was a Croat living in Belgrade. He is still terrified, I heard. In 1991, he was thinking of going back to Croatia. But he knew that if he went back, he would have to fight in their army. Against Georgia, probably. So he decided to go to Toronto, Canada. First 5 years, he was washing the dishes. Now he is managing the same bar. A few months ago, he wrote me a letter saying that he still hates people, especially Serbs and Croats, but people in general. I wonder what would happen to him if he stayed. Would he hate even more? Then my cousin Bojan, the actor. First 5 years of war, he was completely indifferent to it. Slovenia, nothing. Croatia, nothing. Bosnia, nothing. But Kosovo, it certainly pulled the trigger somehow. He started to talk about Serbian monasteries, churches, Holy Land. He started to go to church regularly, to speak about God and justice and Bible. He became possessed with Russia and Orthodox Church, and finally in 1999 he went to monastery. I wonder would he still listen to the Pixies or Jonathan Richman if there wasn't a war? Maya seemed to stay normal. In her head, I mean. But when this hell of ours began, she decided to stay in the kitchen. She became an expert in making the chocolate cakes and pies and tarts and anything with sugar. And fat rich. I wonder would I still be secretly in love with her if she wasn't that fat. If there wasn't Milosevic. So who can tell what happened to me during the war? When everything is over, I'm 12 years older, married, have a daughter, have a good job, few real friends, only a few more pounds, football all around me, a lot of cities, a dog. But it can't be that easy. There must be something abnormal about me and my family, and I can't see it. My friends are like a freak show, my colleagues are annoying, only I am okay. There must be a dark side of myself somewhere inside. Today a court starts to work. Experts say that it will last for years, at least 3 years until the verdict, and then the sentence. So let the good times roll.
Miško Bilbija lives in Budva, Montenegro. Listeners, we want to hear your stories on our show. Radio diaries begin with an email or letter from you. They start as an essay of up to 800 words. We want to hear about your lives, how your lives intersect with what happens in the news. You can email us at onpoint@wbur.org or drop us a line at onpoint, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. That's 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This